Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Score and Chad here, your host for the weekend edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report, where we cover market moves, key economic data, and a number of stocks that we follow along with, mostly in the resource sector. On this weekend show, we're going to try to recap all of the catalysts, all the news that have come out over the last couple of weeks, make sense of it all for some of the trends we're seeing in markets, although a lot of markets, a lot of sectors are still very much range bound and seemingly looking for some more trends. However, there are a couple major trends like the bond market, the rebound that we've seen in gold, and also some currency moves that we will really focus on. To kick off the show, we are chatting with Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also editor of the Mark to Market website. Now, Mark, let's start off with Jerome Powell's speech from this week. We'll touch a little bit on what Jerome Powell said, but use that as a jumping point to a number of these other sectors. Overall, there wasn't a whole lot new out of Powell's speech, really just driving home the fact that, look, the Fed is intending on staying higher for longer, probably no rate hike coming up at the next meeting at the very start of November. But the Fed still would like to see a little bit of slowdown coming in the labor market, even in broad markets and economic activity. Mark, what were some of the key takeaways you had from Powell's speech this week?
And I agree with you that Powell didn't really break new ground, really confirmed what his colleagues had, what most of his colleagues had said previously. I think you're right. It means no hike in November. I think the market has completely priced that out. They were leaning that way in any event, based on what the other comments were. And that's kind of surprising, you know, given the strength of the CPI, PPI, retail sales, industrial production. So despite the strong economic backdrop with firm prices, I think the message got confirmed was no rate hike, and that the bar to the hike is relatively high. And that is partly because for Powell, a good part of the rise in long-term rates is doing some of the Fed's work for it, meaning tightening financial conditions. And so this also takes, you know, have to be taken into account. As we speak here today, the U.S. 10-year yield is up about 30 basis points this past week.
Well, Mark, to that point, you know, with the long end of the bonds, actually those rates surging higher and a sell-off in the bonds there, it is doing the Fed's work for them in a way. We had asked you before the call started, you know, do you think that Jerome Powell and the rest of the Fed is actually happy with that because it keeps them from having to be too aggressive in November? They can still kind of play data dependent to see how things are going for December. What do you think would make them get involved and have to hike again anytime soon compared to the bond market just doing their work for them?
Yeah, so I think the key is what's sustainable. And here's why. You know, earlier this week, before Powell spoke, the 10-year yield was up about the 30 basis points. And the short end, and for there, the short end, when you want to look at the two-year, what I was really focusing on was the December 2024 Fed Funds Futures contract. Where is the Fed Funds going to be at the end of next year? And the market, you know, I should put this in the context. In September, the Fed said there'd be two cuts this year, or next year, I should say, two cuts. The median dot was for two cuts. And so the market was pricing in almost three cuts. And so based on this string of stronger than expected economic data, the market took that back. And so before Powell spoke, the market, the short end, it's December 2024 Fed Funds Futures, the yield had increased by about 15, 16 basis points. So I had thought that about half of the increase in the bond, in the 10-year note yield, was really a result of changing expectations of Fed policy. But as we finished a week, that December Fed Funds Futures is practically unchanged on the week. And the 10-year yield is still up 30 basis points. So what that means then, I think to your point, Chad, is that it's true that now we've got to accept Powell's argument that the bulk of the increase is what he called the term premium. And that's where that tightening of sort of influence is expressed. And so the key, though, is what's persistent? Where are we going to be a week from now, 2 weeks from now? Short-term moves don't matter so much, but they do give us a hint of what's possible. And so I think the Federal Reserve is prepared to hike rates if necessary. But if the market's going to do the work for them, and they don't want to over-tighten, which is why I think Powell so stressed so many times about being patient and careful. I think he knows that they're at the tail end of the hiking cycle, and I don't think that the economy is so sensitive that 25 basis points is the difference between a growing economy and a recession. But I think that from the market, the psychological point of view, I think it's important. But I think that we're going to see we got to see what happens in the next few days. But we don't really get any important, I mean, I'd say vital economic data until we get the next jobs report in early November.
So, Mark, it just seems to me if the Fed wanted to stop this sell-off in the bond market, well, they could. They could step in and either start buying bonds or even more so stop unwinding their balance sheet. And just having Powell not really address the fact that bonds have literally crashed over the last 3 years back to 2007 levels, it almost seems like the Fed is okay with the bond market, doing the Fed's job for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think of course, they had this big adjustment. I mean, imagine the adjustment in Europe where they had negative yielding bonds, 10-year yields below zero. And then, so the adjustment, of course, from a zero interest rate world that we were in those early days of COVID. So there's been this big adjustment. But I think from the Fed's point of view, I mean, I think that it's been relatively orderly. And Powell played down the risk that might be coming from commercial real estate. And he also played down the stresses on banks, saying that things seem to have stabilized since that March flare-up. Though, of course, it's partly because the Fed itself is lending about $108 billion, in that facility they created, and a couple hundred billion dollars in the discount window. So it's not completely independent of what the Fed does. But I think that the Fed is relatively calm about this backing up of yields. And the idea of restarting QE, I think, is a non-starter. Is that you only have to do that, QE, when you're at the zero bound. When interest rates are near zero, that's why you would do QE. But I do hear people talking about that the bond market is crashing and it's unstable. But I look at the recent auctions, including this past week's 20-year auction, which is not really a duration that people really like, but it was fairly well received. We did have some auctions previously in the quarterly refunding that generated a tail, seeing this kind of sloppy after where the where it goes out at versus where it's trading in this when issued market. But I'm still looking at the debt market being oversubscribed. Yes, what I think ultimately is happening is that below the surface, there's been a change of who's buying U.S. treasuries. It's no longer the central banks. It's not OPEC anymore. It's hedge funds. It's insurance companies, pension funds. And so I think that it's gone from, in some ways, a market segment that's less sensitive to prices to a market segment that's more sensitive to prices. But I don't think that we're in a fiscal crisis here in the U.S. Yes, interest rates are rising. Yes, the debt servicing costs are rising. But I don't see a sign that we're in crisis. I see it more of a sign as an adjustment. And, thinking about our 10-year yield near 5%. So what are we going to see next week? The Atlanta Fed says we could see that Q3 GDP rose by over 5%. The market's not quite there. I think the latest survey in Bloomberg median was about 4.3%. But if you give me 5% growth, give me a $1.8 trillion budget deficit, now give me inflation that's even though it's come down, still elevated. I don't think that a 10-year bond yield at 5% is so outrageous or crisis material.
Well, Mark, they have to have higher rates for the long-term bonds to attract buyers. But to your point, it's not the central banks that are buying, and it's also not big foreign investment that's been buying. There's several articles that have come out over the last month or two talking about it's not China, it's not Saudi Arabia, it's not India. There's not a lot of there's not a lot of countries that are buying these bonds. So maybe it is the hedge funds and it is the institutions and the pension funds and insurance companies. But when you translate this over to investors and to people's 401k plans and to people's retirement plans, you know, people that have a 60-40 portfolio, they're not just getting hit in the general market pullback lately. They're getting whacked on the bond side big time. That's normally where you had safety in your portfolio, where you had stability, and it's actually outperforming to the downside, the general markets. We saw that last year in 2022, and we're seeing it again now. What do you make of this effect on the general investors and the general people's retirement plans? Because as the bonds sell off, that's going to hurt people's overall financial outlook and that wealth effect.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, the savers have put money, financial assets, stocks and bonds, have this dramatic adjustment, like you say, to these host of things post-COVID. And it doesn't look like the adjustment's completely over yet, though many suspect that we're at the tail end of that adjustment, whether it's going to be stronger earnings, whether it's that the stock market rallies before earnings bottoms, whether it's that interest rates, Fed policy is near a top. But I'm still not, I mean, yes, so here's the story that I would think. People who are savers did fairly well in 2020. The economy didn't do well, but holders of financial assets did do well. And many Americans had reduced the exposure to fixed income because it paid so poorly. And so many of us savers have to make this big adjustment, give back, in effect, some of the money we made in 2020 or 2019 or 2021. We've got to give that back. And that's what's happening now. And I think it's always a question, I think, of risk management that, you know, it's, of course, for many people, it's like shooting. They'd say it's like shooting a fish in a barrel when you have a rising stock market, falling interest rates, like we did for so long. And we're in a different investment climate. And I think we have to all make this adjustment. But I think it comes down to risk management, how we do that. But I also think that I don't really see foreigners really boycotting U.S. markets. In fact, earlier this week, the Treasury Department reported the TIC data, which is in the U.S., the Treasury Investment Flow Report, TIC, comes out in the middle of most months. They had $134 billion net foreign purchases of U.S. assets. And I hear you, it's not like the end-all and be-all number, but what it does show is that maybe what was really going on, and this is what I think we saw from China. Yes, they sold agency bonds, they sold treasuries, but you know what they bought? Bank deposits and T-bills. They're not really leaving the U.S. They're just trying to act like prudent money managers, shift money from the part of the market that is selling off hard, the long end, and putting money at the short end. I think that's just prudent investment. And what happens is many of us get caught up in what they're doing with the treasury bonds instead of thinking about what they're doing from the overall portfolio. And again, I think that the dollar has been fairly resilient. And I think it'd be a different story if we saw U.S. bonds and stocks selling off and the dollar selling off. I'd say, okay, foreigners are taking their money home. We're not really.
That's the big picture that I wanted to get to here, Mark, is what you're seeing in the currency market, understanding that as much as we're talking about the crash in the bond market in the U.S., bonds around the world are going down. So this is kind of a everybody's game. And maybe it is just prudent investing, people moving into money market funds, other type of assets, shorter term duration bonds to get that yield. But again, what have you seen in the currency market when you do understand that the bond markets around the world have been selling off?
Yeah, so the dollar has been strong. I'd say that the dollar made its highs earlier in October, around the time of the U.S. jobs report. And it's been, I'd say, broadly consolidating. I would sort of take the point that given the strength of the, what looked like strength of the employment number, the retail sales, industrial production, I would have expected the dollar to be stronger, but it hasn't. So first thing I'd say is a currency that's an instrument, right? Just our trading experience, right? Something that doesn't respond well to good news is sort of like a yellow flag. It's telling you something might be up. Secondly, I'd say that partly there is a safe haven bid going on. You know, we talk about how gold has rallied, oil has rallied. In the currency markets, we'd express it, a couple of currencies that would be safe haven currencies, people would think. One of them would be the Japanese yen, but that's not really participating at a safe haven. We got as close to 150 where people think the Bank of Japan may be intervening, as close as we could possibly come earlier today. But the currency that's been the strongest since in the past 2 weeks, so since the Hamas attack, has been the Swiss franc. It's really the only G10 currency higher, and it's risen by about 2% against the U.S. dollar. The euro is basically flat. And the weakest currencies are those that are associated with, like, risk on, Norway, New Zealand, Australia. We've had some poor data from the UK, and sterling has been under a little pressure as well. But generally speaking, the dollar, this week, I think the dollar index is off by about 0.5%. So, but broadly speaking, the dollar still is at the upper end of where it's been this year. And I think that, you know, with a little bit more of a push, bad news from Europe, expanding of the war, something could drive the dollar higher. It's not, for me, then, what I'm saying is the price action hasn't convinced me that a high for the dollar is necessarily in place. But I'm looking for it to turn. I've just been wrong about the timing of it.
Well, Mark, you also brought up the uncurrency of gold there. It's kind of like its own financial asset class, and it's usually a headwind for a strong dollar and for surging rates against the gold price. The fact that gold price today on Friday, as we recorded this, popped up over 2000 for a little while. It's now back down below that, and we don't know where it's going to close today. But just the fact that it's as high as it is, considering how high the 10-year was, up near 5% earlier this week, and that the dollar is still around 106. What do you make of that dynamic?
Yeah, I think it's, so you're right. You know, usually I think of gold as moving in the opposite direction of the dollar, moving in the opposite direction of rates. Higher interest rates typically bad for gold. To me, this tells me that there's like a third factor that often is small, but has like exploded, and that, of course, is geopolitics. I think people are, it was still in the early days, it's only been 2 weeks. Israel still has not, its Israeli Defense Force have not had that ground invasion of Gaza yet even. And so we're still in the early days, and I think people are nervous, are worried. We saw that Ray Dalio from Bridgewater suggested there's a 50% chance that we end up in a world war. And so I think that gold is really reflecting the geopolitics. In the spot market, I hear what you say about the futures market getting above 2,000. The spot market stopped just shy of that. It seems to me that if there's not an expansion of the war, we should look for gold. I mean, that these late longs could be vulnerable, that they, you know, that people sort of capital flight into it. But once there's peace or some more convincing sign, people give up the idea of the war expanding, then I think we can see gold come off.
Yeah, who knows what's going to go on with that war, but this week it seems like it has unfortunately kind of picked up steam. Any key levels that you're watching in gold that would maybe change that outlook away from it just being kind of this geopolitical move?
Well, I think for me, I'm looking at 1950. There's a retracement there. It's the old highs we made, say, in August and September. So I think a break of 1950 would convince me maybe that it's worth shorting or thinking that a top's in place.
What about oil, Mark? Because it's also been surging. Sometimes when you see gold and oil surging together, you know, you kind of see that as a flight to safety. A lot of people thought oil was going to be left for dead when it was surging down in the low 80s. Now it's back up closer to 90 again. It's around 88, 60, 89 today. What do you make of oil's jump higher?
Yeah, so I think it's the same kind of thing. But I think I can understand gold's rally on the war. I don't really understand oil so much. And there's some other kind of interesting news this week that should have been overshadowed by the geopolitics concern. One is that it becomes clearer that the U.S. is sort of, I don't know, closing a blind eye or not enforcing some sanctions on Iranian oil. So more Iranian oil is coming into the market. And this week, the U.S. seems to have struck a deal with Venezuela that's going to allow for Venezuelan oil, more Venezuelan oil to come to the market. It's going to take a couple of months or so, but a 25% increase or so. And remember, U.S. output, oil output, is also at record highs, up about 10% this year. And so I kind of thought that the supply issues have eased a little bit. Demand remains questionable. I mean, I think that's why I was pointing out the U.S. GDP number should be strong. China is talking about, reports suggest that it's considering raising its import oil quotas. The refiners seem to be working at, have a very strong demand there. And so the surplus that we might be seeing in the oil market there is really going to turn into a product surplus, pushing down the products of the refined oil. So I am watching oil. I like the fact that in the December contract held the 90 level. And we just got very close to 90, coming back off. I'd like to think that oil is near a peak. But again, it all depends on the geopolitics.
Yeah, geopolitics back in this market big time. But you know what? You have outlined some of the economic data, especially out of the U.S., that we are going to get next week. We all kind of know that the Fed's in pause mode, though, especially for the next meeting, because of what the market has done and because of what the bond market, the sell-off has done there. So how should we view any of this economic data, because of the fact it doesn't seem like it's going to drastically move the needle for the Fed in the near term?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that we shouldn't expect the Fed to raise rates, of course, in November. What should we be looking for if they're going to raise rates in December? Well, here's what I'm looking at. I think that the way I understood Powell is that the bar to a Fed hike, so they lean against it. They think they're done. But if the economy shows more acceleration, so I'd be looking for data coming in November that picks up early part of Q4, that's October data, beginning with the jobs report, some sign that even though we might not have seen it in September, some sign the economy is losing a little bit of that, the oomph, the pizzazz that lifted us so far in Q3. And so the two elements there, I think we're going to see this when we get the GDP next week, is the consumer very strong. We need some sign that the consumer is pulling back. And so far, credit stress levels, like credit card stress levels, delinquency rates, those do not seem to be doing the trick yet. And so I think if we see the so I think that we're at the fork in the road. Weaker economic data, some slowing down, will take the pressure off the Fed to raise rates, which the Fed does not want to do. Like you point out, the market's done some of that for them, and they think they have done enough in any event coming into this month.
What about the labor markets, Mark? Because there was a couple comments Powell made, and I haven't seen this covered very much in the financial media, but when you listen to what Powell was talking about, he was not looking at the labor markets, whether those are going to tighten or not. I think they're worried about wage-based inflation creeping up and pushing up the inflation numbers, possibly in the service sector. What do you make of that dynamic as far as their focus on the labor markets?
Yeah, I think that Powell's not so much focused on the labor markets causing the tightening. They're causing the main challenge. I think he sees it as a strong labor market boosting income, which boosts the demand for goods. So I think that he's really more focused on the demand side. I thought I did hear him say something to the effect that wage growth slowing closer to what's going to be consistent with the Fed's inflation view. So more work needs to be done. And I think Powell is pretty clear. I mean, I think that the Fed itself generally is surprised by how well the labor market's holding up in the face of the rate hikes. And so they're sort of, that's why I think they want to be patient. Powell said this, I think, I forget his exact phrasing of it, but he did say that there was a large, he used some word for large, like amount of, I think called it meaningful tightening still in the pipeline. I think this is what he wants to be careful of, because he wants to be tightening. I mean, yeah, I think he wants to be careful realizing that the labor market should be slowing. We haven't seen evidence of it yet. And what should you do? Should you rush and do another, you know, should you tighten further, or should you try to be a little bit patient and see if it's just a lag time involved here?
So then, Mark, I guess to wrap us up, from strictly the investment angle here, how do you relate what we're going through right now to any other times in history? And if you had kind of a bull bear index, where would your needle lie?
I don't know. I don't remember something as painful as this, but remember why, too. We've had, a 40-some-odd-year decline in long-term interest rates. And I think most people think that world is not coming back anytime soon. And so we've got to make this, it's a 40-year adjustment we've got to make. And so I think it's painful. Those kind of adjustments always are painful. Where am I in the sort of bull bear? I'm afraid that we still have some more work to do on the downside. Sometimes I think we go through some windows of opportunity where maybe this is like a good buying opportunity. Maybe the down move is over. We're still higher on the year, but to me just today the S&P 500 is holding the 200-day moving average, which we really haven't crossed. We haven't traded below it, I should say, since the financial stress in March. We're testing that today around 42.35 in the S&Ps. And we go through that. I don't know if there's much stopping us before we go down to 41 or so.
All right, Mark. Thank you very much for your insights here. We covered a lot, but I think there's a lot at play outside of these geopolitical concerns. And again, it's that bond market that has absolutely just fallen on its face and completely changed that narrative that, as you said, everyone got used to over that 40-year period. Mark, thank you very much for your time. Everyone, stick around. We are going to be right back covering a bit more of the big picture macro here. If you want to follow along with Mark, be sure to visit his website, Mark2Market.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.